So today's theme, as I shared earlier, is seeking the unity within and without. And we had a whole bunch of responses online around this question of what does an underlying changeless reality beneath all change mean to you, and what's a practice that helps you ground yourself into that essence of things. So rich theme in that sense, and even richer personal story of Swami Vedanand. And Somik, who's going to be our moderator, he himself has got quite a journey. I won't go too much into the details, but one of the things I absolutely love about him is the title of his PhD thesis. And this is not, I don't think it's his formal title of his thesis, but this is the way I like to frame it. And it's I think of it as the value of values. And so here's a guy who went to Stanford and he studied the value of values. And he's telling all these big people in the world to make decisions that are aligned around values. So Somik himself comes from a very deep background of trying to align into these values. So Somik, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Fantastic. So good. Thank you for agreeing to do this. And Somik, for those of you that may not know, he actually spent the night yesterday at the monastery where Swami Vedanand is, and really just set it up and has this whole thing going, and it's so beautiful to see him put his heart into this, as he does everything, as he does into everything he puts his mind to. So Somik, thank you for joining us. Any thoughts about today's conversation? Swamiji, I know, is somebody that both you and I have known, but you have known a lot longer and in a lot more of an intimate way. Any particular thoughts before you start the conversation?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very interesting and personal moment for me, because even before I knew you, Nipun, it was Swamiji who told me, you know, there's this interesting guy, his name is Nipun Mehta, and, you know, his parents host this Awakened Circle. And before that, at that time, it wasn't called Awaken. And that's what led me to service space and all these, you know, the wonderful ecosystem. And Swamiji often said, Nipun's my hero. So that is a very, you know, it's a great honor to be here to see the confluence of two of my heroes in the same call. So I'm very grateful to be here. And on Swamiji, I must say that his presence has been amazing for so many people at Stanford, and I'll give you more of an introduction later on. But I've never seen him get angry. I've never seen him ever lose school or ever. And Stanford can be a pretty tough bunch to handle. I mean, we have questions from hell where he comes and attends these classes. But somehow, in spite of all the difficult questions, people come back with a lot of peace.
And Somik, I have to agree with you on that, because yesterday I was talking with Guri, my wife, and we were just, I was saying how, you know, we'll compartmentalize spiritual cultivation. You know, this is on the cushion, this is off the cushion, this is at the monastery, this is in the market, and at some point all of those start to blend together and everything becomes a field for cultivation. And I remember telling Guri yesterday, I was like, you know, Swami Vedanand is one of these people that you just get this, he's just so steady, right? I mean, he's just like, I have not seen it. It just seems like he's cultivating through it all. And it's really inspiring, I mean, to just know that kind of steadiness. Like, all we may go up and down, our context may go up and down, people may challenge him, he may be rushed, but he's still going to be right there, you know. He's still going to be the same Swami Vedanand that we've come to know in practically any moment. So I just want to underscore that point that you're sharing.
Yeah, it's been incredible. And I even remember once there was an interfaith gathering at Stanford, and someone took exception to something Swamiji said, and I was really curious to see how he would respond. And this person, who was a little upset, you know, had heard something in a particular way, and Swamiji not once tried to explain his comment or anything. I was struck by how compassionate he was, and he completely went over to the other person's point of view and completely agreed. And basically, this person would come for an argument, didn't know what to do next because he found that Swamiji was on this person's side. And that was a remarkable conversation for me to witness.
Awesome.
A quick introduction to Swamiji. So Swamiji is from the Ramakrishna order of monks, and which traces its lineage to the Puri order established by Shankaracharya a long, long time ago. And I won't read much of his formal bio, but basically he has a PhD in physics from Berkeley. Before that, he did a bachelor's in physics from MIT. So he has a very interesting academic background, and from physics he transitioned to being a monk. And I'm hoping he'll tell us some of those stories today. But my personal introduction to him would be the amazing impact he's had on so many students at Stanford. In particular, there was a time, 2005, when students, we had organized a yoga class for ourselves, and at some point the students felt that we wanted to go a little bit beyond stretching exercises. We wanted to get into the philosophy. So we reached out, and Swamiji immediately agreed to come. And we didn't even know that he was driving 2 hours from Olima and, just would hang out with us. And we wouldn't even offer him any food or water, nothing. And he would just be delighted to be with us. And there'd be days when just two or three people would show up, and he would be just as delighted as when we would have a full house. It made no difference to him how many people showed up. So these small things, they mean a lot to, in terms of walking the talk and just enjoying. He just enjoys living with this wisdom of seeing the changeless. So when I read this on paper, it sounds pretty academic, but when I hear it from his mouth, it feels like it is real. It's totally real, and makes me want to aspire to see this. What is this changeless? That reality that is at the essence of things. So with that, I would like to begin with a question for Swamiji. So Swamiji, you have a PhD in physics, as I mentioned, from UC Berkeley, and you were at MIT before that. What attracted you to the monastic path? Can you share a little bit with us about your life prior to a monk that led you to becoming a monk?
Well, thank you very much for the introduction. It was so flowery. I thought you were talking about somebody else. I couldn't for a while figure out who you were talking about. But anyway, thank you. Now, the background of my association with Vedanta, which is the particular order of monks, the Ramakrishna order, is one of the, as Swami was saying, one part of the Dashanami Sampradaya that was founded by Sri Shankaracharya originally. But our particular section is our particular order is the Ramakrishna order, which means that the inspirer is Sri Ramakrishna, and he gave the vows of sannyasa to, in a symbolic way, to his original disciples. Then the order was officially organized by Swami Vivekananda. So this is our particular lineage. So I came to the order in that way through Vedanta, through in particular the Vedanta Society in San Francisco, which was at that time, which was about 1959, it was led by Swami Ashokananda, who was an extraordinary person, and it is through his influence that I became interested. He was a very very intellectual, very not only compassionate, but very I mean, he could express the very needs of the very essence of spirituality in such a clear way that it became, I mean, it was so lucid, so transparent that it was like an acid, you could say, that cut through the heavy steel of my resistance and finally wore it down. It took me several years just to even begin to admit that there could be a possibility of truth in what the Swami was saying. But I was totally fascinated, and I kept coming back, even though I really could not understand or appreciate his exposition. But somehow there was something about it that was fascinating. And after a number of years, I finally decided that this had to be the way to go. And once that decision was made, then it was nonstop all the way.
Thank you, Swamiji. So I want to dig a little bit deeper about your vows. So becoming a monk is a pretty serious undertaking, and it's not just like, hey, I want to learn how to play the guitar, then you do it in your leisure time. So what kind of vows did you take? In other words, how did your life change after becoming a monk?
Of course, the vows that monks take, especially of the in the Dashanami order, that is the Shankaracharya's order, there are certain traditional vows that are taken. They're actually not so much vows, but declarations. The actual vows are generally the vows of Brahmacharya and that are taken during the Brahmacharya ceremony, that is the preliminary ceremony. When you become from a probationer, you become an actual member of the order. For some years, you start as a probationer, and then you take these first vows, which are really, in this term of vows, those stay all through the, even after sannyasa. But the sannyasa ceremony is a set of declarations that are made about the reality of things and about the way we're going to live afterwards. It's a declaration of our understanding and of our total commitment to this purpose. And that is the emphasis. The emphasis is on the totality of it. This is a one-way street, but a one-way street in the sense that the way itself becomes the goal, because there is no there's no difference. There's the basic understanding is that there's only one reality here. There's only one reality, period. And even you cannot even say that there is one reality. You can only say there is. And So the what you commit to is to live like that, to live as Brahman, as the infinite, as the eternal. Not that you want to understand something or realize something, because you are that already. You want to live that way. Now, in a human way, we say, what have you realized? Have you realized this? Have you realized that? But that's not the the main emphasis. The main emphasis is it's a statement, a declaration, you are that. And there's not even any question of living or not living this way or that way. The point is, you are that. And that itself is, that's just why it's a finality. There's no question of going back or going forward or anything. You are that. That is the emphasis.
And after making this declaration along your journey, did you ever have any doubts about the monastic path?
Well, if you've once committed yourself to this. There is actually no question of a path anywhere. You're not going anywhere. That is the main difference. It's nothing that you have to attain. You are that already. And the commitment is to live like that, and in a sense to overcome any attempt to deviate from that firm commitment.
You mentioned being inspired by Swami Ashokanand. I wanted to focus a little bit on him. So we've heard stories that he was dream initiated by Swami Vivekananda, like how he once, and we've heard stories of how he once went up to give a talk, and he just looked at the audience in silence and left, and many were in tears. Can you share some stories of the life of Swami Ashokanand and what inspires you about him?
Well, the main thing is that it was so transparent and so visible that he was totally committed to this concept, and he was living this in this way, and the sheer logic and intensity of his commitment was what was actually communicated. There wasn't any question of there being two things or a choice between this and that. The reality was this, that Brahman or Atman or the Lord or whatever name you want to give it, the reality, the Buddha nature, that is not only the truth, that is all that exists. There is nothing else, and it becomes a commitment to live that way. So that was what was impressive about him. He was so totally the embodiment of what he spoke, what he talked.
So some have noted that nowadays less and less youth are being drawn to such ideals, but perhaps there's still a spiritual draw, but just not in the context of a traditional religious organization. What is your sense of the youth and the attraction to these ideals today?
Well, it's not a question of organizations or anything. I think there is a great hunger for clarity, and that is, I think, the main thing that we can try to achieve ourselves and try to inspire others to direct their lives and their efforts to. The effort to understand what is real here, what is true here, and that can be expressed in so many different ways. Each religion is an attempt to, or is actually a formulation of that very idea. It isn't that Vedanta alone, or Hinduism even, or any particular religion is the only approach to this, that all religions, this is what Sri Ramakrishna realized, that all religions are so many representations of this path, and each religion has in it whatever it takes to guide its votaries to this goal. But the thing is, if you are you interested in the goal of attaining to the reality that is here, to get to the foundation of what is real here, or are you interested in more limited ideas? The more limited the goal, or the more circumscribed the goal, I only want to head to do this, or I only believe in that, then there's a problem of contradiction, a possible contradiction between various expressions of that goal. But if one is aiming at that central idea, no matter how it's phrased, then that is, but I think that is what people nowadays are especially qualified or especially concerned or especially devoted to. There is, I think, if anything marks the modern age, it's the desire to get to the heart of things, to get to the reality of things, not just in theory, because there's so much has been written on that, but to actually experience that within each one's own life. And that is a tremendous and a valuable and incredible aspect of the modern age. And communication is so thorough and so instant that nothing can be hidden anymore, at least very little can actually be ultimately hidden. Sooner or later it will come to light. So I think nowadays what characterizes people is a hunger for reality, a hunger for truth, a hunger to get at the heart of things. And that is a remarkable aspect.
I want to dig a little bit deeper on that point. So you touched quite a bit on different faith traditions, and you've been known in interfaith dialogue to show great respect to Christ, Mother Teresa, Buddha, Islam, and other traditions, even those that sometimes might challenge you. And I know that I've seen your altar, and it has the image of Christ and the Buddha along with your teachers. So it's one thing to tolerate other religions, but people who come and interact with you, this kind of thinking, they come away with a deep regard of all faiths. And even atheists seem to enjoy interacting in this way without feeling the need to change their beliefs. And this sounds pretty incredible to me. So can you perhaps touch a little bit on what's at the core of the belief system that makes this possible? Maybe if you can share some stories from your life or from Swami Vivekananda's life or Sri Ramakrishna's life to illustrate this.
I don't, first of all, I don't believe that there is something that, or that there is a category of people that's called atheists. I mean, there are people who may not believe in theism. So in that sense, maybe literally, they could be called atheists. But everyone believes in himself or herself. The fact that I exist, and so everyone is a believer. The point is, are you a believer in a traditional sense or not traditional sense? That's the only difference. But there's no one who does not believe in himself. There's a fundamental reality there that everyone is, by the very fact of being conscious, that they are conscious of, and that's the background of their experience. And and yet every expressed belief or every expressed religion, every expressed philosophy is subject to being challenged, because it is something that is formulated by human beings. If it is expressed in a certain way and in a certain context, and because it is expressed like this in a certain way, in a certain context, it can be challenged. And one could maintain that maybe one expression of it is more satisfactory to oneself than another expression. And that's why we have so many different varieties. It's to fulfill the needs of all the people. Swami Vivekananda expressed the wish that there should be one religion for each person, because everything is so individual. And however you try to phrase and formulate a religious idea or religious doctrine, it's not going to be satisfactory for everyone. So really speaking, each person has his or her own religion, and but there are certain common sympathies that we can share, even though we may disagree on certain specifics. So it's these common things that should be emphasized. Everyone is really, in a very real sense, makes their own religion, even if you are officially following the doctrine that's promulgated in a certain context. When you try to understand that, it is your own understanding, and it will not be shared by necessarily others, even of your own faith. So this is the emphasis that everyone has that truth within. Everyone is cognizant of that fact, whether they admit it or not. Their very existence radiates the idea that they understand a certain basic truth, a certain basic reality, however it may be phrased. So it's religion, and whichever particular religion you adopt, becomes an attempt to clarify that to oneself. What is it that I believe, and how am I going to actually experience that in life? That is the struggle, to actually experience what we believe. We may profess so many things, but how much have we dedicated ourselves to in reality, and how much have we actually been able to experience, and how much have we actually been able to desire to experience? So it's the fundamentals that are important, and the particular expressions of it will have to vary from person to person.
I wanted to get a little deeper into this idea of reality, and I know the big theme of your life has been about seeing the changeless behind all that changes. And at this point, I want to bring in a question from a member in our ecosystem, Lavanya. And she asks, what does one hold on to when one realizes that everything around, including one's ideas of I am, what I want, are changing all of a sudden? How does one maintain equanimity in that state and understand what the changed self is? And when you say there is something beneath everything that does not change, what are you referring to, and how do we know?
In order to be aware of the changeless, of the changing, in order to be aware of that which changes, in order to be aware of our own selves in a particular context, in the world, in a particular society, in a particular culture, in order to be aware of one's own existence, one has to first of all be aware of the changeless. Unless you, Swami Vivekananda made that point very clearly, unless there is a changeless screen, you will never see a movie. You can say, okay, you can make a statement, well, there are holograms that don't require screens. That's a technical point which I leave to the to the technicians to figure out. But my point is, even that's only an example, so it should not be, no example, no illustration should be driven beyond the point that it's trying to illustrate. What I'm trying to illustrate is that Swami Vivekananda's idea that in order to perceive anything, there has to be a changeless background, a changeless reality on which the changing is perceived. And who is it that is perceiving the changeless? Sri Ramana Maharshi made a great point about this, who am I? And that's the same point. Who is it that is asking the question about the changing? And what is the basis of the changing if there were nothing changeless? But you can look at it in another way, in a purely scientific way. Whatever you look at in physically is obviously, and nowadays, earlier it would have been expressed in a different way, but nowadays we know that though things look very solid, if we look at them in detail through a microscope, they look different. If we bring in an electron microscope, it still looks different. Then it becomes a set of molecules, and where one thing ends and another thing begins, you don't know precisely. You can't tell where a solid object ends. Because of, say, simply a gradation in density of molecules. So solidity, that which is solid, that which is real, if you look at it ever more closely, it seems to vanish in it, from molecules to atoms to protons, neutrons, electrons, quarks, all these things that are now known about elementary particles. You just keep on looking, 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 and you never come to the end of it. There's always something else. Even vibrating strings now, people talk about that. That's even, you know, at a more fundamental level. So you never come to the end of looking at the multiplicity. But the point is that the that which is the many can never be perceived unless there was a consciousness. Your consciousness is the one steady point in a totally changing, constantly changing universe. Everything around us is changing all the time. And everything around us really is, you could say, undefinable in its precision. I cannot precisely tell anything. The uncertainty principle, for one thing, illustrates this. The more I know about one thing, the less I will know about something else. So these are all different aspects of the same question. Science is characterized by this thing, that if I want to understand something really fundamentally, I can look at it more closely and I can say, okay, this thing is made up of certain particles. Then I look at each of the particles and I say, each of these particles, what is it? What is this proton? Well, the proton is made up of quarks and things. And what are these quarks made of? And so I can ask, what is each thing made of? And the answer is always, well, it consists of other things. But we never answer the question, what is it actually? So science tends to answer the question, what is the actual nature of anything, by simply taking it apart and saying it consists of these pieces. And then you take each piece apart and ask about it, and you say the answer is, well, it consists of further pieces. But what it actually is in itself is not, you know, that is never known. It consists of pieces, and I can look at those pieces, which consists of pieces, and I can look at those. It's endless until we get to these vibrating strings, which no one has been seen and probably may never be able to see. But the basic question, what is it, is never answered. And when we rephrase the question or rephrase our thought upon it, we can realize that one possibility is that the essence of everything, the reality of everything, is not the material that it's made of, but the consciousness that I'm seeing it. In other words, that consciousness is the basic reality. And this is, of course, we're getting to the Vedantic idea, consciousness, sat chit ananda, existence, consciousness, which implies joy, that that is the basic nature of the universe. So anyway, these are the trends of thought that have interested me.
I want to turn the heat up a little bit and ask you maybe a difficult question now. So you've been known to say that when something bad, quote-unquote bad, happens in the universe, God has not gone to sleep. God is still right there. So what do you mean by that in the context of what many people experience as evil? Is there such a thing as evil? And on a sort of related note, Swami Vivekananda had said, in essence, the one who believes in a God that is all good believes in a one-legged God. Can you help us understand that a little bit, and you know, any stories that you might have?
Well, of course, there's this aspect of Hinduism which is so puzzling to people who are not used to it, namely the worship of the terrible, which is symbolized by pictures of, say, the Divine Mother in various realms. And there is a poem by Swami Vivekananda which shows this aspect. The thing is, as long as we feel that God is good and have no heart, Swami Vivekananda himself said that if we have no heart for God in the terrible aspects of things, then we're believing in a one-legged God. The thing is, that which is, there are several aspects to it. That which is terrible, yeah, may be terrible to one group of people, but may not be terrible to others. That's one aspect, but that's only a very superficial aspect. The point is that this universe is built in such a way that all these things are possible, and all of these things, in fact, do happen. So the question is, how do we react to it when it happens? In two different ways. When it happens, and we can do something about it to prevent misery from occurring, to prevent suffering, to prevent destruction, to prevent fanaticism, then definitely we should do everything that we can to prevent that. But if you, and then if cruelty comes, we have to stop the cruelty from occurring. If injustice comes, we have to strive with all our might to for justice and for fairness, for equality, for generosity, for love. That we have to struggle with all might and main. There are no two questions about that. If cruelty is being done, it's our responsibility to do something to prevent its occurrence. But that is not the basic question when you're talking in a philosophical way. The basic question philosophically is, what is this cruelty? I mean, cruelty or injustice seem to be concurrent with the existence of the universe. It just seems to be there. If you stop it in one area, and it is our duty to stop it wherever, whenever it comes to our attention, there's no doubt about that. But the point is, why does it occur at all? What is its significance? How are we to think about it as differentiated from what are we to do about it? The point is, neither cruelty nor generosity is at the heart of the matter. That is on the level of behavior, on the level of action, and there we have to protect the good and chastise evil. There's no doubt about that. But what is good and what is evil, and are they separate things? From a philosophical standpoint, there's only one reality. That is what the sages throughout the ages have experienced, and that reality manifests itself as good and manifests itself as evil. And what is the reality itself? Does the reality have a good aspect and a bad aspect? No, the reality is only itself. Existence, consciousness, and infinite bliss and joy. And we see it as good and as evil as it operates on the surface of things. But the fundamental reality is just characterized by this existence, consciousness, and that infinite calmness which comes from seeing non-duality, from seeing the essence everywhere. So the essence of things is neither good nor evil. It manifests that way, and on the level at which it manifests, we have to do something about it. But fundamentally, there's only that one consciousness.
So I want to drill a little bit deeper into this, because this is a very, very deep idea here. And we, in fact, in our ecosystem, we had a whole bunch of questions on equanimity. I'm just going to pause for the phone to stop. Okay. In our ecosystem, we had a whole bunch of questions on equanimity. And this is of much broader interest. So I'll read a little bit to set the context. So one of our members has this question. I wonder if I get treated like a doormat and invite more abuse by not standing up to resist and fight against what I forgive. The eternal Gandhian ethic of turning the other cheek to shame the assailant does not work when dealing with sociopaths. How can one be equanimous when one needs to engage in violence in such situations? Does living in equanimity mean never getting angry? When was the last time you were annoyed by something? And connected to this, Michaela asks, how do you process the havoc created by climate change and worldwide acts of terrorism and still maintain your equanimity? So how do we get this to the practical level where we can practice this?
Yes, this is what we were talking about just a few minutes ago. At the level at which action is required, action is to be undertaken in the Bhagavad Gita, which is one of the principles, the scriptures of Hinduism and of humanity as a whole. Arjuna is urged by Krishna to fight, and that struck me as being very, very strange that. When Arjuna is making all these statements about non-resistance being better than resistance, why should Sri Krishna ask him to fight? Well, the point is, Sri Krishna did not ask all of his disciples to fight. There was another disciple, Uddhava, who was asked to go off into the Himalayas and become absorbed in meditation. Arjuna was asked to fight. It's the question is, at what level are we operating in this world? There are certain times when resistance would generally be admitted to be necessary for instance, if you see someone actually harming someone else, you're the bystander, you're watching one person injuring another, killing another. I mean, and then you say, no, I'm going to stand there and I won't do anything. Or if you have one particular agency that is committing huge acts of terror, and you say, no, I'm not doing anything because I believe in nonviolence. Well, that's fine if this is your path. you feel that this is your, you know, you want to see the reality and everything, you're not going to answer that way. You're not going to offer any resistance. One could question that. One could say that that's not justified, that if you see a thing to be a terror, like you feel, you see someone is being gravely hurt by something, for you not to do anything about it, one could definitely question whether you're justified in remaining aloof. The thing is, if you are have reached this spiritual state where you see the presence of God everywhere, then you will not actually see anything as being, in other words, it won't be a question of you're seeing the suffering of someone else. You're seeing that it is God who is present everywhere. When you see God present everywhere, there's no question of resistance. But short of that, when you see that actually the what you see in front of you is someone being hurt, being unjustifiably oppressed, then to maintain you're not going to do anything about it is disingenuous. It's unfounded. If you see a problem, then it's our obligation to try to solve the problem. But if you see that it is God alone who is acting, then you're justified in saying, okay, this is actually action. The question of whether you should act or not does not even arise. If the question arises as to whether you should act or not, then definitely you should act. That means you have not reached that state of equanimity. If you reach a state of equanimity, the question of whether you should act or not does not even arise.
Swamiji, I want to request you to share the most powerful story of Swami Vivekananda that comes up for you right now.
Well, the most powerful image of Swamiji that comes up right now is when he was walking back and forth on the porch at Belmont in the monks' quarters there in Belmont. He was walking up and down on the porch, and he was weeping, and he was, at one time, he put his head on the rail and wept bitter tears, and someone came up and said to him, Swamiji, why are you so sad? And he said, oh, there must have been, I feel a terrible catastrophe must have happened somewhere in the world. People are suffering so much. That is why I'm overcome with this feeling, great feeling of sorrow. And the person who was watching him felt as though the whole universe was sympathizing with Swami Vivekananda in his great sorrow. Later on, it was found that there had been a catastrophe somewhere, and many people had perished. And so it was verified that this feeling that Swamiji had was actually an occurrence. But to see that great hero in that condition is tremendously inspiring.
Thank you, Swamiji. I'm just going to jump in with a question. We do have a bunch of people in the queue, but just related to what you said, it seems paradoxical that if, as you earlier said, if cruelty and generosity aren't at the heart of the matter, it's really our consciousness and the question of experiencing that that consciousness. What is the basis of compassion then? Why would someone like a Swami Vivekananda, who's so tuned into the changeless and the changing, what would be the source of his grief and his experience of the human suffering, and at the same time an overflowing of compassion? Is this just what we're wired to experience, or Or how do you? It seems to be a paradox. Would love for you to shed light on that.
The compassion comes from a feeling of oneness. I feel the sorrows of others because I feel one with others. And the basic idea of any religion, really, and Vedanta certainly, it's at the heart of Vedanta, is that feeling of oneness. I and my brother are one. That is the point. If anyone in this universe suffers, it is my suffering. If anyone in this universe is full of joy, it is my joy. I'm one with everything. I'm one with all. That feeling of being one with the universe, of not being separate from anything, that is a spiritual realization. That is at the heart of spirituality, and it's at the heart of all compassion. It's the heart of all feeling of greatness, feeling of dedication, feeling of spirituality. Oneness is the, if you trace it to its core, it's the feeling of non-difference, which is the basic teaching of really of all religions. Jesus said, I and my Father are one. You can interpret it in various ways, but the words indicate that same spirit of oneness.
And still, even when you have that oneness, there's still a sense of suffering and pain that you would feel of other people.
Yes, because if something hurts, if I feel a hurt within myself, I feel the pain of it. I want to do something about it. If I feel the whole universe is one, that I'm one with the whole universe, the reality of the whole universe is pulses in my own heart. I see no difference. I react to the pain everywhere. I also react to the joy everywhere. But in particular, this pain is what enlarges our heart. In fact, there is an idea called it's called Sarvamukti, which Swami Vivekananda was asked about. The idea is that I will not accept liberation until all are liberated. This is the Bodhisattva ideal in Buddhism also. And from a strictly Vedantic orthodox standpoint, one can question this. What do you mean you will not accept liberation until all are liberated, because there is only that idea of oneness? But and Swami Vivekananda's answer was, yes, you're right from a philosophical standpoint, that is true. But imagine the greatness of heart of a person who feels that he will not accept liberation until he has striven and succeeded in bringing all others to liberation before him. Then he will walk into he will attain that state, like Yudhishthira walking into heaven at the end of the Mahabharata, but only after all others, including the dog that accompanied him, had attained liberation. Then he would accept it.
Wow, that's beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you, Nipun. I'm Devin, and I'm calling from Orange County, California. Swamiji, I have a question for you. And my question is, when I'm wrapped up in my day-to-day routine, the fear or the experiences from the past make me react. And it could be my ego, it could be just my fear, or it could be just my attachment to something. When I'm quiet on a Saturday morning, I can think of consciousness. It doesn't happen so easily on Tuesday afternoon. So my question is, what can I do to feel that consciousness or that connection in the heat of a moment when I'm angry or fear or I have anxiety?
The point of anger, fear, anxiety, and how to deal with it. Of course, this is one of the prime questions, how to make these ideas practical. It's the, if one feels the presence of God everywhere, that is the major tool, feeling the presence of God everywhere. Now, what is God to one person is not God to another person. So, in other words, but it helps if one can choose one of these great luminaries of the world or some symbolic, maybe a being that may or may not have existed in physical form, such as Shiva, the Divine Mother, or other aspects of divinity, or God, in any way one likes to think about it. If one can have a personal relationship with a reality, in other words, the worship of God. God is my own God, as the source of all my joy, or any particular incarnation or divinity or some divine reality. If I can accept that as the entity that I speak to. In other words, prayer is one of the essential needs of human beings. And prayer can be like the child's prayer to its mother. Mother, give me a cookie. And mother says, no, I will not. It's not good for you. It'll ruin your teeth and this and that. But the child said, mommy, please, a cookie. And you know, the child may eventually understand, no, it's not good for him, but it feels better, it feels assuaged, it feels answered, it feels satisfied when the mother responds to it in some way. So that personal connection with divinity is one of the greatest tools that we have for making all these ideas real. God need not be an incarnation in a physical sense. It can be just a great feeling of love and devotion to whatever reality we understand as God, or as something that's very precious to us. In other words, to have that, to go back to, that to lean on, that to rely on. After all, we are all children. And in one sense or another, we may be pretty old, but in our hearts, we are all children. We all need that divine, that motherly affection. And if we can somehow establish a relationship with a divine reality in the sense that one can approach it like one approaches one's parents, that enables one to control these the things that one wants to control, to achieve the things one wants to achieve. That is one way. It's not necessarily the only way, but this is one way definitely one can achieve great help and great compassion and great, actually great success, if one can achieve such a thing.
we have a whole bunch of questions that have come in, also online. David Doan, I believe from somewhere in Europe, says, Swami Vedanta, many people believe that Jesus resurrected from the dead. What is your interpretation of the resurrection story of Jesus?
Of course, if you excuse me, if you talk philosophically, that's one thing. If you go according to tradition, then you could come to you could say, well, I don't know if the tradition is true or not, but. The point is that the body of Jesus certainly at some point or other would have passed away. Whether he died on the cross and was then laid to rest in the sepulchre, or whether actually, as some people believe, he did not actually die on the cross and then went on to maybe even travel to India and this and that. There are different traditions surrounding that. That sort of scenario you would have to decide for yourself what seems reasonable. But from a philosophical standpoint, that which was called Jesus as a physical entity certainly at some point will have to pass away. There are stories like Trilanga Swami in Varanasi, who was supposed to have lived to 320 years of age, and there was Methuselah, who was attributed to have lived 800 years or something. But nevertheless, after 360 years or 800 years, they would have passed away. So the question of physical survival is beside the point. But the point is, did the spirituality of Jesus pass away? Did the essence of Jesus pass away? No, because the essence of Jesus is the essence of the universe. And that will not pass away as long as we are conscious of the existence of ourselves and of the universe. So the essence of spirituality can never pass away. It is the essence of everything. It is the essence of Jesus and is the essence of ourselves. And it's that oneness between us and Jesus. I and my Father are one, he said. That is the what enables us to understand and realize and appreciate and reach for that infinite which is present everywhere.
Thank you. B double E has this question. My family often treats me like I have my head in clouds. A simple question. Do you have any advice for an individual who embraces her spiritual nature, but whose family does not accept her interfaith beliefs?
Well, a person's beliefs need not be shared with anyone else. Whether other people accept the belief or not is, you know, up to ourselves to deal with, but it doesn't really make any difference whether someone else accepts what you believe or does not accept what you believe. The point is, do you really not only believe it, do you feel more and more in your heart that this is a solid truth? At least it's a truth that's solid enough to base your life upon. If you feel that, it doesn't matter whether other people accept you or accept your belief of it or not. You need not, I don't think one need to worry about that. One simply goes on, and one is going to believe what one believes, whether other people accept it or not. So, and that's quite justifiable.
Good morning. My name is Pallavi. Thank you, Swamiji, for such a wonderful morning. I would like to go back to something you said in the beginning of the call about your vows and living from a place of I am that. So, yeah, this is a multi-layered question, and I'll let you take it wherever you want to, which is, you know, when you start out, it is probably an intellectual thought, I am that, and then I'm assuming at some point there's an awakening and you recognize you are that, and after that, how did you personally not learn, but continue to operate from that higher place? So the question is really, you know, I would like to know how you dealt with it, or do you tend to slip and take your awareness back to that higher plane, or what are the challenges of living from the place of I am that?
Well, I would phrase that perhaps a little differently. I am that means you have to define in some sense what that is. But the basic truth of it, that we're really trying to achieve is the truth is I am. I am that means I have to define that, but I am doesn't require any definition. And that is something which each one of us will readily be able to feel. And that's why if we're very quiet, that feeling of existence, I am, is a very profound feeling. And it's not, it isn't, you don't have to define it. The very fact I am gives you a profound feeling of existence, of solidity, upon which you could base the rest of your thought, the rest of your life, the rest of your relationships, and all that are based upon this very, this one central fact: I am.
Wow, that is beautiful. You just transcended that with what you said. Thank you.
I will go to, before I go to a caller in the queue, I will ask a question from Jen. I'm not sure where she's from, but the question reads, from what I understand, the purpose of different paths of yoga, Raja Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, Jnana Yoga, Karma Yoga, is that some are better suited to one path or another. In a parallel way, some are called to one worldly vocation, versus others are called to another vocation in this life. However, in one of the examples from the Upanishads, Krishna asked Arjuna to fight, which is the very path he's most, or I think she meant Arjuna, to fight, which is the path he's most conflicted by. And so the question is, in the absence of full consciousness, how can we trust our own discernment in choosing our own path?
I think the first thing is to decide what is it that I'm fundamentally interested in, or what is it that I need to fundamentally answer in order to live this life at all? What is my most fundamental need, spiritually speaking? And once one has chosen that, once one has approached the question of existence in the most fundamental way, then the answer slowly will unfold itself in our own life. The main thing is to decide what is real here, what is the most fundamental aspect of reality that I want to give myself to, or that I can lean on. What is that that I can lean on that will not crumble when I lean on it? That's the basic question. And when one has gotten an outlook that supports that, then from then on the idea is to live in that consciousness, that which is most central to one's being. That is what one should concentrate on, and how you do it, the techniques or the rituals or the methods you use, those will be in the particular religion or thought pattern or philosophy that you've accepted. There should be techniques or ways recommended in order to be able to reinforce this, in order to be able to make that central in our lives.
There's a question from Bansi Pandya in Arizona. And the question reads, do we have free will? And if time ultimately doesn't exist, how do we relate to our experience of the past and future?
The Swami Vivekananda made the point that that free will is a misnomer. Anything that is, if you talk about will, it cannot be free. Because if you talk about will, you're talking about a finite idea, and Anything finite is bound to be influenced by other things that are finite. So he made such statements about the idea of free will. But from a limited standpoint, he also acknowledged that we must have the idea of freedom, otherwise we cannot act at all. So free will means, can I do what I want to do when I want to do it? And it seems that way. It seems that we can. But if you examine it, or if you think about it later in very specific detail, you find that most of what happened has been influenced by the past, by past actions that have guided you to act in a certain direction. So the recommendation always is do good and be good, which was Buddha's recommendation. Do good and be good, and it will lead you to whatever ultimate good there is. The thing is, if you do good and are good in the sense that, in the highest sense that you understand for goodness, you will create a habit in yourself to do good, and then after some time it will be impossible to do evil. And as you rise higher and higher in that practice of only being concentrated upon the good, the infinite, the eternal, the real, you'll get to a point when it'll be impossible for you to think of or concentrate on anything that is not good and not eternal and not real. So this is how doing good and being good, being true, being totally devoted to these ideas, it becomes impossible not to, it becomes impossible to act contrary to those ideas. You've created a habit that will force you to be good and do good and head toward that which is good, which in the ultimate sense will lead to that which is beyond good and evil, will lead to that which is the essence of good, which is beyond good and evil. And that essence is the essence of the universe, that feeling of oneness.
Namaste, Swamiji. Thank you for everything. I think my question has already been answered. Thank you so much.
That's always great. There's a couple of related questions to your past comment. One is from Arye in Half Moon Bay. He said, he wrote in saying, you said that if one has reached equanimity and feels the presence of God everywhere, then the question of responding to cruelty and injustice does not arise. You also said that when we are in a state of oneness, we feel the pain of others, we feel compassion. So his question is it possible that we are to be simultaneously, is it possible that we can simultaneously be in a state of experiencing God presence everywhere and also being of this world where we feel the need to act?
Exactly. No, this... the feeling God's presence everywhere is the essence, and then whatever else happens is individual to each one of us. So if we feel God's presence everywhere, then seeing God's presence everywhere, if we actually, the struggle then is to live in that, to maintain ourselves in that, and as it becomes ever more real, as I was saying the last time, as this doing of good or as seeing God's presence becomes ever more real to us, then whatever we do will be filled with God's reality, will be filled with God's presence. So it becomes, culminates in a total absorption. That's the principle. Now, if you want to say this, how can you actually fight and do all sorts of cruel things while you do that? That is the tension that exists in this world, that if one's job is such that, as Arjuna's job was, to carry on this fight and to do all of this, how can one do this in the spirit of feeling the presence of God and the spirit of detachment? That is the challenge for us in each one of our lives. How can we live our life in such a way? And many of us in our lives, we have to do things which are, which are not necessarily the sort of thing that we would want to do. I mean, like Arjuna, a soldier is called to defend his country, defend the innocent people, but he has to perform all these cruel actions. How does this happen? And how can you justify it? The point is, the first obligation is to feel the presence of infinity, of divinity, the presence of reality. You have to ask yourself, what is real here? Existence, that consciousness, that joy is real here. And to live our life so that we begin to experience that. Then if we're called upon to do all these things, we will have to do them in that spirit. If we're called upon to, like Arjuna, to fight, he has to fight. The whole point of Krishna's sermon is he has to fight in having established himself in the consciousness of the presence of God everywhere, seeing the divine form or seeing the divine reality everywhere. Now he has to act. He has to perform his actions. But if he performs his actions, whatever they have to be, with the consciousness of the reality of God and the presence of God everywhere, even though he may not see it, he may be a spiritual aspirant, not a person who has actually realized this, but the more he aspires after that, the more real it becomes to him, and the more he will be able to act in an appropriate way, even though he may, like a soldier, have to do cruel things. But if he does them with a consciousness of God's reality, the actions that he actually undertakes will be tending toward reinforcing the reality of God. And though on the surface they may appear to be cruel, like Arjuna's, in actuality it will lead to an ever deeper realization of the presence everywhere. This is of course an extremely difficult question, and the whole of the, Sri Krishna gave this sermon in the original part in chapter 2, and he had to go through, till chapter 18, until finally Arjuna says, okay, I've understood. And in the process, he went through chapter 11, which shows the universal form and shows God in a very specific, very sort of fantastic way. So it's a very difficult question, but the point is our mind should be concentrated on infinity so that it becomes a habit, and then slowly our actions will become in consonance with that. But it's not an easy thing to do, and it's something which takes practice.
That's beautiful. Unfortunately, we will not be able to get to everyone's comments and questions, but we will. We do have one last one. This is from Tejas. It says, Swamiji, how does one instill his faith back in divinity? Once lost, is it possible to reinstill that faith back in one's heart? And is believing in karma and divinity one and the same thing? So perhaps your thoughts on karma.
Karma.
But I think that's the core of his question is, if you don't have faith, how does one instill that faith? And if you've lost it once, how do you regain it back?
You cannot lose it. Your basic faith is that I exist is is the basic faith. The very fact that a person asks a question means that faith is there. He has faith in that reality. I exist. That much we know for sure. Now, the point is, if one is able to feel that there is a reality which underlies one's life, that is the core of the matter, that I feel that the basis of this universe and the basis of my own reality is a consciousness or is an existence, that the basis of this universe is not non-existence. It could not be. There would be no contact. I would not be conscious of anything if I were not conscious of existence first. One should have the feeling that I am. In the Bible, it says that Moses asked God, to define himself, basically, and God said, "I am that I am." That feeling of "I am" is the basic feeling in all of us. Without that, life is totally impossible. Life, even the question that's being asked, cannot be asked if you don't have the feeling "I am." So that is the basis. Now, on that, the feeling of existence, the feeling of consciousness, the feeling of reality, that is at the core. Now, if one feels that there is a reality in this universe, and that reality is at the core of my own being, that is the basis. Whether one has faith in a particular form of God, in a particular aspect of religion advocated by certain faiths, that comes later. But every one of us feels "I am," so that basic faith can never be lost. "I am" means also that everything that I perceive is. In other words, others are. If I am and others are, that means there's a universal bond is automatically created. And that universal bond, that universal oneness, I and my brother are one, I and my sister are one. If I have a feeling of that the bond is there, and it's obvious to everyone who exists in this universe that bond has to be there, that is spirituality. I and my father are one. I and my brother are one. I and my sister are one. That feeling of oneness is religion. And everyone has that. You cannot lose it. Once one has that feeling of oneness, then everything else follows. I am one. I am one with all. I am one with this universe. So all of existence is based on compassion, on a feeling of oneness. So all of religion follows from that very idea of existence. And how you specify it, how you make it particular in your own case, that is up to you and up to the system that you want to follow. And all of these things are details. The basic feelings, I am, and you, my brother, you, my sister, are. That feeling of oneness is the source of everything. From them comes all goodness, comes all feeling of love and appreciation and joy. From that comes all holiness. And when one feels that sense of oneness with everything in the universe, I am one with the universe, that is God. There is nothing else in this universe but God. And one becomes more and more dedicated and devoted and immersed in that. So that is religion itself.
That's beautiful, Swamiji. Also a great way to bookend our conversation here. We are that. And there's no getting away from it. And I think that's the message that at least I was consistently getting from everything that you're sharing. Before we end the call, we do a couple of things, but one question that we always ask all our guests, and I am particularly excited to ask this of you, which is, you know, how can we, as sort of the larger service-based community, support what you stand for, support your work in the world? What would you have us do? We all have so much gratitude, and we'd love to pay it forward and do whatever we can, and would love your thoughts on that.
The best thing to do is for that feeling of excuse me, that feeling of oneness to spread, and that there is a reality, and that reality is my own self. I don't have to go anything beyond that, the belief in my own self. If that idea spreads, that religion and spirituality are really at the core of everything, that all other things, economics, politics, whatever, you know, whatever we do in this world, everyone, if everyone can be a little bit conscious of the fact that this is, you know, the essence, that I don't need anything else.
That's a classic question. How can we support you? Spread the feeling of oneness. I love it. And it's kind of like we were chuckling, Preeta, who did your bio, and she was like, wow, that's a... There were a series of five questions that were asked, and one of them was, act of kindness you'll never forget. And Swami Vedanand's response was, being accepted as a monk in the monastic order founded by Sri Ramakrishna and Swami Vivekanand. And then we really got a chuckle out of this one. One thing on your bucket list. And he says, I don't know what is meant by the expression bucket list. So it's beautiful, Swamiji, just the way you are. It just brings so much joy to so many of us. And I know Somik and I feel very privileged to have had this small opportunity to be of service to your message of oneness. Somik, any closing thoughts before I conclude the call?
Yeah, I feel very deeply that Swamiji's words and these ideas are like a balm on our soul, especially when we feel a little bit broken. And every time I hear Swamiji speak, I feel like I'm standing on a rock. And I remember once that I asked him that, you know, once we go away back into the world and we forget these words or these ideas, then we again get confused ourselves. So can you suggest a test? How do I know that when I'm in the world out there that I'm actually doing karma yoga or action that is freeing and action that's not binding? What's a test? A really practical test. And I still remember his words. And he said that when everything you do with the best of your effort completely flops, completely fails, you're crashing and burning. In those moments, do you still retain your sense of humor? And if you do, then it's quite likely that you're probably on the path of karma yoga. And so I love that aspect, that all of this is not philosophy for him. This is actually practical reality. And his huge contribution to at least my life is to make it practical, to help me practice it. So, yeah.
Thank you. And thank you, Somik, also for orchestrating this call, doing all the hard prep work and making this a labor of love. Also, super duper thanks to so many people behind the scenes. We had Davin catching the tweets and spreading them online. Like, I think the one that he posted on our back end chat was, unless there's a changeless screen, you will never see a movie. Rahul, who's going to be doing the audio, was also doing the same. I think one of his quotes that he posted up was, this universe is built in such a way that all things are possible and all things do happen. The question is, how do we react when they happen? And Kozo, who is also on, and he posted this tweet from Swami Vedananda as well. When you see God presence everywhere, there is no question of resistance. And of course, so many more. Swamiji, you'll be happy to know that actually the person, there's a bunch of people who will do the post-call follow-up, and the woman who is editing the audio, Radha, was actually Swami Prabhudananda's doctor in his final days, and someone that puts a lot of love into all this, and so just a lot of it takes a whole ecosystem to put on just one of these calls, and I just want to thank all of them, and most of all, thank you. Without you, we wouldn't have this opportunity to be of service today. We are extremely grateful and honored to have had this time together. And as a way to say thank you, we just want to hold a minute of silence in the spirit of gratitude. And then after the silence, we will do the non-silent way of gratitude. We'll put everybody off hold, and we'll all just say this wonderful, chaotic thank you. So maybe a minute of silence. Swamiji, thank you again.